One idea that's been put forward as well is to show how others could be included in Israel. Here's this person. She was a Moabitess. She comes. She's now part of Israel. And maybe it's a story that was written at a time where that was an issue. People were being kept out of the people of Israel. And somebody wrote a story to say, you really can't keep people out. Because look at David's ancestors. She wasn't an Israelite. And what if she never came? We wouldn't have had David. So maybe that's part of it. Especially if this is written in response to Ezra. And again, I'll talk about the timing of the book in a moment. But Ezra, remember, you have the period of the kings, and then at the end of that, you have everybody who's left in Judah, who's important, essentially, gets hauled off to Babylon. And there they are. And when they come back, the two main people are Ezra and Nehemiah, and we read about those in the books by their names. But one of the things that they do is they really take a hard stance against any foreigners. Let's just get rid of all the foreigners. We're going to just be Jews here. And perhaps this book is written as a response to that hard position that they're taking, that isn't a fair position, that there are many people who, again, they want to believe in our God, and if they want to participate, God never said no. So why are you doing this? Another reason that's put forward is maybe it's just to also be... I don't think any of these are one thing. If there's any reason to book, it's probably multiple things. But here's another idea that's put forward, to show the work of God in the lives of people. This is one of those stories where it's not like some of the stories in the book of Judges. You know, an angel shows up and says, you're going to have a son, and he's going to be this amazing guy. There's nothing like that in this story. This story doesn't have any overt workings of God. All the things that God does are all behind the scenes. He's working, but it's not something that's in your face. There's no angel, there's no prophet. It's just people living life. And ultimately it leads to the coming of David. And I think that's another important message in the book. I think it's all of those kind of things that are involved here. God prevailed in the life and history of David's ancestors. And he did it with the patriarchs. He did it with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And it's interesting. I mean, you have little glimpses of the activity of God in some miraculous form in Abraham and Isaac and Jacob, but not much. And this kind of throws back to those kind of things. People just living life. God raised up David. God raised up any foreigner who seeks Yahweh. So any foreigner who wants a place in Israel, such as Ruth, she's allowed to have that place. God used a Moabitess to bring David to the throne ultimately. Now, another thing I've talked about before and I want to note here and probably cover again in the future sometime, a substantial portion of David's core army were foreigners. I have told you that there's some practical reasons behind that. One good way to make sure you were not assassinated from the throne is to have nobody around you who will assassinate you. And I think David was good at that. His army around him, he also, remember, he had traveled around and he had spent some time down in the land of the Philistines. Do you know, in his army, there were 600, David's personal core army, 600 Philistines. The guy who goes out and kills Goliath has 600 Philistines working for him. That's a lot. And we already know he has, you know, Uriah the Hittite. His core bodyguard, his mighty men are foreigners. I don't think David particularly trusted people. The city of David, which, not Bethlehem, the one that he took over and lived in, the city of the Jebusites, it was a city that was full of Jebusites. Do you know that? He didn't go in and massacre the city. He took it and made it his capital, but the Jebusites still lived in the city too. David's palace was built by Phoenicians, as was Solomon's temple. So when you look at the temple building in the Middle East, you go back and you study archaeology. David's temple, Solomon's temple, although it's following the design of the tabernacle, looks an awful like everybody else's tabernacles and temples. It's not that different than what you saw in Egypt or you saw in Phoenicia. So these things are important to understand. If David, here's this man, if he's willing to have so many foreigners participate in his rule, He wasn't opposed to them. Sometimes we read the Old Testament stories and we think, wow, everybody was at odds with everybody. It wasn't that way. We saw when we looked at the life of Samson, what happened? They were intermarrying with the Philistines. Everybody was getting along pretty well. It wasn't as bad as we sometimes think it is. Now, the literary form of Ruth is short story. Okay, it's not prophecy. It's not history. It's a short story. It's a story. Now, when I use the word story, it doesn't mean it's fiction. It's like when I said, let me tell you a story about when I was a kid, right? Okay, I'm just telling you a story. It's the format. That's what this is. It's a short story. It has nothing to do with whether it's fiction or nonfiction. It's a story. Other stories that are in the Bible that would be similar in some regards are Esther. That's a short story. A very well-written story, just as the book of Ruth is. The story of Joseph from Genesis is a story. It's a short story. That's why you have everything going up to his point, all these stories of people, and then boom, you got this big section that's just the life of Joseph, and then after that it goes back to all this other interaction, because it's a collected story of Joseph, and it's put into its place there, the story of Joseph. Other extra-canonical books are also similar. They're in the form of a story. Judith, Tobit. Have anybody ever read some of those books? Yeah. They're really interesting. And if you read Judith and you read Tobit, you'll know right away why they're not in the Bible, especially Tobit. But those are short stories. They're fiction, clearly. Then it gets to the next point. When was this book written? And again, the ideas on when this book is written, very, very wide room involved in here. Part of the reason why it's so important to know when things are written is why it was written depends on when it was written. See, if this was written when Ezra is kicking everybody out who's not Jewish, that would really contribute to the idea that he wrote it to say, what you're doing, Ezra, is wrong. If the ancestors of David, going back just a few generations, can come in from Moab, then why are you kicking everybody else out? See, the timing is important. If this is written not long after Solomon's rule, then it's, again, showing some history. It has a different portion of the reasoning why that comes into it. Problem is, we just don't know. We don't know who wrote it. We don't know when they wrote it. We don't fully know why they wrote it. So the suggestions flow sometime after the writing of the book of Judges, certainly after that, and we place that well after the establishment of the monarchy. All the way through to after the exile in the time of Ezra and Nehemiah, or even some people would put it even farther down the road than that. We just don't know for sure. And lots of people will have different theories on that. Perhaps the evidence suggests that it was written during Solomon's reign, but again, we can't be sure. Let's get into the book itself. Let me read for you a little from the book. In the days when the judges ruled, and this is just this introductory thing, it expects you know this part of Israel's history, there was a famine in the land, lots of stories with famines, and a man of Bethlehem in Judah, which is really significant. We just had a couple of other stories in that area in the book of Judges, went to sojourn in the country of Moab, he and his wife and his two sons. The name of the man was Elimelech, and the name of his wife, Naomi, and the names of his two sons were Mahlon and Chilion. They were Ephrathites from Bethlehem in Judah. They went into the country of Moab and remained there. So there's the famine in the land. You see stories in Genesis starting that way. Remember how often? There's a famine in the land, so they went to Egypt. There's a famine in the land. You know, have these famine stories. Why would you go to Moab? You know, there's a famine. They could have gone to Egypt. Well, they weren't to return to Egypt. Anyway, it doesn't really matter. The cause of the famine, we're not told there. Ultimately, it serves God's cause. The famine comes because God wants it to be there. But the author just kind of mentions it as a reason for them to leave Bethlehem. I mean, Bethlehem. Bethlehem, we've talked about this before. Bethlehem means house of bread. The house of bread is empty. They went to the cupboard and it was bare, so they had to go to Moab. And that's important in the story. So this man, his wife, his two sons, they leave. His name is Elimelech, which if you break it down, you have El, which means God, if you want. We've talked about the El being the name of the chief deity and the Hittites there. And Melech, which means king. It's like Melchizedek. Okay, you have the king in there. All right, so his name means God is king, or my God is king, or El is king, however way you want to break that down. His wife's name is Naomi. We don't know exactly what it means, but probably something to do with pleasant or lovely. Her name is similar to that. The son's name's Mahlon, Chilion. We don't have a clue what they mean. I mean, nothing. These are strange names. We have no other connection to anything. They were Ephrathites, it says. This may have been merely the name of the area that they were, Bethlehem Ephrathah. Or they may have been descendants of Caleb, which is more likely that these are descendants of Caleb in this particular story because of a historical name, Ephrathah, in there. Well, to move to another land was a big deal. You didn't just pick up and move to another land unless you had a real problem. And this is what they were doing. Because when you left, it's not like you're, well, yeah, we're moving out of state, but, you know, you got telephone and internet and mail, and it's not that different. When you moved out of state or out of country in those days, it was a big deal. You left your clan, your support group, your family. You left your God in some regards because the worship of your God would be not done somewhere else. You're going to have Aramaic spoken throughout the region, so there's going to be some connection in language. But you're definitely going to be known to be a foreigner. Even within Israel, remember in the story of Judges, they were crossing back over. Say this magic word for a shibboleth. You can't say it. Kill. You know, so accents were really strong, just as they are now. We recognize that in some of the other stories in Judges when people just wondering, oh, you're not from around. You must be from some other place. Very, very, very strong accents, very strong regionally. And you see that even today, you know, village to village to village in some parts of the world. I mean, they just speak differently. And it wasn't any different among these. You think, you know, here's these people and they have their nation. They didn't speak uniformly. So when you moved to another country, you didn't do this rashly. You did it very, very, because you had to do it. Well, anyway, on with our story. But Elimelech, the husband of Naomi, died, and she was left with her two sons. These took Moabite wives. The name of the one was Orpah, and the name of the other Ruth. They lived there about 10 years, and both Mahlon and Chilion died, so that the woman was left without her two sons and her husband. What a sad story. There's a famine in the land, so she moves away, and then all her husband and her boys die. The boys had married Moabite women. Orpah and Ruth, we don't know who married who. It's not really clear in the text. It's not particular. One thing that's important to note here, it's not forbidden to marry a Moabite. It's not forbidden. But one thing we do read in Deuteronomy 23, 3 and 4, it says, "No Ammonite or Moabite may enter the assembly of the Lord, even to the 10th generation. None of them may enter the assembly of the Lord forever, because they did not meet you with bread and with water on the way when you came up out of Egypt, and because they hired against you Balaam the son of Beor from Pethor of Mesopotamia to curse you." There was no love lost between the Israelites and the Moabites, at least when Deuteronomy is written. Now, Deuteronomy, this verse that I just read, this is really the text that Ezra and Nehemiah are using to say, get rid of everybody. We don't exactly know what it means to never enter the assembly of the Lord, whatever assembly of the Lord means there. It's interesting, though, to me. Did it mean they couldn't be part of the priesthood, Levites, if they intermarried that way? Did it mean you couldn't really worship the same way at the temple? David's got a real problem, is my point. David is only just a few generations down the road. And so here's this huge black mark put on his family tree because of this Moabitess. He's not allowed to enter the assembly of the Lord, whatever that means. So you can see why the possibility remains that this is written as a response to Ezra and Nehemiah, saying, you sending away all these wives and children is going too far. The Ammonites and the Moabites are, incidentally, the descendants of Lot by his daughters, according to Genesis 19, 36 to 38. Remember what I've said before about that. The black mark put upon these people forever and ever. Well, they had lived in the land 10 years, and the boys died. Jewish tradition alternately blames the death of these boys on the fact that they married the Moabites and that they left Israel. They couldn't make up their mind. The Jewish tradition, oh, that's because they left the land. God struck them dead. No, it's because they married the Moabites. That's why God struck them dead. You see the wrangling over the reasoning here. But we're not to miss the tragedy here. This woman, Naomi, and in some ways, I think the name of the book really should be Naomi. It's really a story about Naomi, not so much a story about Ruth. This is a story about Naomi. It's about her life and how God worked in her life, not so much Ruth. Ruth is an important person in the story, but really the story is about Naomi. The woman, it says here, the text doesn't say Naomi lost everything. It says the woman. She's reduced. Her identity's wiped out. She has no husband, no children. She's not the mother of anybody. She's not the wife of anybody. She's nothing. She's the woman. She lost her homeland, her husband, her children. All she has left is her life. But that life is full of pain, remembrance of all the painful loss. She has nothing to look forward to in the future. She'll never bear another son. She's too old. She'll probably never be married again. She'll have no one to take care of her. She has a very bleak outlook in life. And then Naomi hears that the famine is over. She arose with her daughters-in-law and returned from the country of Moab, for she had heard in the fields of Moab that the Lord had visited his people and given them food. The word visited is important. He's come and dwelt among them. So she set out from the place where she was with her two daughters-in-law, and they went on the way to return to the land of Judah. But Naomi said to her two daughters-in-law, "Go, return each of you to your mother's house," not their father's house. "May the Lord deal kindly with you as you have dealt with the dead and with me. The Lord grant that you may find rest, each of you, in the house of her husband." Then she kissed them, and they lifted up their voices and wept. Note that when she leaves where she leaves with the daughters. This allows her more easily to resist the pressure to stay. If she said, "I'm packing up and I'm leaving," they would say, "Oh, don't go, Naomi, don't go." But if she's already packed them to leave and they're coming along with her, it's easier for her to say, "You guys go back." You know, they're out there on the road somewhere and she can send them back. There's less pressure on her to go back with them as well. It says, "You can go back to your own mother's house." She's releasing them from obligation to her. And, of course, her to them. She's breaking all obligation between them. She says this, "May God deal kindly with you." And this is one of the most important things about the story. This is one of the chief themes in the story, this word kindly. May God deal kindly. Kindly is an important word in the story. And for the Jews, it's about loyalty. It's about reliability. It's about kindness and compassion. This is one of the ideas through this whole story. Those who treat one another in a particular way, God is blessing them. The word appears throughout the story, and I would summarize it this way: sacrificial love for another. If you look at the people who practice this, they're practicing sacrificial love. They aren't thinking about themselves and their own needs. They're thinking about someone else in the story. That's this word here. Where the word doesn't appear, it's heavily implied. And those who act with it in this story will be blessed. She also says, "The Lord grant that you may find rest, each of you, in the house of her husband." The word rest there is important. Rest doesn't mean that you cease from working. It's a different word. To rest means to settle down in a secure place, to be settled securely. That's what rest means. And it meant security. We will see this word again in the book of Hebrews, very prominently for a long section. If God had given them rest, why didn't they have it? Why did he speak of another day? So here's this word given here for them. May you be secure. May you find a new house, a husband. So she kissed them, and they all had a good cry. And then, I love that part. And then they said to her, no, we will return with you to your people. And it shows that she must have been a very good woman. For these women to even suggest this, you know, some people say, well, it's just bartering back and forth. No, they really would have done this. And that should, I mean, she's got no prospects to really offer these girls anything after this point. And yet they're willing to go with her. She must have been really incredible. And we'll talk about that in again. Because they were willing to give up everything to be with her. But Naomi said, turn back, my daughters. Why will you go with me? Have I yet sons in my womb that they may become your husbands? Turn back, my daughters. Go your way, for I am too old to have a husband. If I should say that I have hope, even if I should have a husband this night and should bear sons, would you therefore wait till they were grown? Would you therefore refrain from marrying? No, my daughters, for it's exceedingly bitter to me for your sake that the hand of the Lord has gone out against me. A lot of stuff in here. Lot. She said that she wasn't going to have any more kids. I mean, she couldn't have. That would take the place. And the idea here is the idea of Levirate marriage, where the brother marries the son. And we see glimpses of this through the Old Testament. If one son dies, this is in the law. If a person dies, the brother takes that wife, and then the son that is born, he carries on the brother's name. And that has to do with a lot of the territory that needs to be protected. Land got passed down in families. If a family line dropped out, where would that land go? This was the part of the process that's important here. Naomi didn't want them to refrain from marrying, know that this was all an impossibility. So she wants them to stay in Moab. But she says this thing here at the end, no, my daughters, for it's exceedingly bitter to me for your sake that the hand of the Lord is against me. This is very important because we see into Naomi's heart. Naomi feels God is against her. I mean, think about it. Who wouldn't? Who wouldn't think that? Her husband, there's famine in the land. They have to move away. She leaves her family. She leaves her friend. Then her husband died. Then her boys die. When bad things like this happen to you, you begin to think that God is against you. And she says so. And she says, you girls will suffer and are suffering because of me. She didn't use the word, but I'm cursed. And if you hang around me, it's not going to get any better. And then they all cried again. Yeah. Yeah, it's hard to say. One of the things that is in there, it says, return to your mother's tent. It doesn't say to your father's house. Return to your mother's tent. They would go to live in the tent of the mother. And that was a place where men weren't allowed to go into. That's where, instead of staying with Naomi and living in Naomi's tent, they'd go to their mother's. But at least they'd be with their mother's. But they would be somewhat of a burden, potentially. But they would have the potential of being married again to people in their own land. It's just one of those unknown things. It's not specific. But the idea of the mother's tent is crucial there. In fact, in the story of Isaac, when Rebekah comes, he goes into his mother's tent. Rebekah's in the tent of the women. That's where he goes to meet her the first time. All right. Anyway, Orpah kissed her mother-in-law goodbye, but Ruth clung to her. And this is, at this point in the story, you see Orpah deciding going home would be better then. All right, you're freeing me and you're compelling me to go. I will go back. Really, there's nothing wrong with her choice. And this is one of the things in this book that you have to see, and we'll see several times. There's nothing wrong with her choice. In fact, Orpah does the sensible thing. We see this throughout the story. We have people doing the sensible thing. There's nothing wrong with that choice. It's just laid out there. It's not condemned. It's a fine choice. It's a wise choice. But when we see somebody doing the other choice, there's a blessing in it. That's not a promise in it, but we just see it happening. Again, later Jewish tradition, you know what they do? They make Orpah the ancestress of Goliath. You know, come on, kick people while they're down. But that's what happens when you get to write the history books. Ruth decided to stay with Naomi. It says she clung here. The word clung is used to show commitment. It's used of marriage. It's used of interracial marriage. So she's choosing to cling to Naomi, who is of a different nationality. Really, it's a word that's used anytime there's a person required to leave one group and join another. This is the word that's used here. And she says this. See, your sister-in-law, Naomi is saying, has gone back to her people and to her gods. Return after your sister-in-law. But Ruth said, do not urge me to leave you or to return from following you. For where you go, I will go. And where you lodge, I will lodge. Your people shall be my people and your God, my God. Where you die, I will die, and there will I be buried. May the Lord do so to me and more also if anything but death parts me from you. This is an incredibly powerful oath she's just taken here. This is an oath. Where you go, I will go. Your people will be my people. This is something we hear all the time, people quoting this particular thing. Her commitment, she says, her commitment to Naomi will outlast Naomi. That's what she's saying. Where you die, I will die. I will bury you there and I will stay there until I die too, is what she's saying. She's not saying, I will bury you and then I'll come back home or I'll go somewhere else. She's saying, where you die, I will die. She's saying, my commitment to you will last longer than your life. It will last my life too. Very, very powerful commitment. She won't return to her own old life after Naomi's life is over. She swears an oath to God to stay with Naomi. She says, may the Lord deal with me, be it in the NIV, be it ever so severely, or may the Lord do to me and more so, as it says in here. Lots of ways to say this oath. I like the phrase in the NIV, may the Lord deal with me, be it ever so severely. That's what she's saying here. May the Lord do so to me and more also. And this is the only time in the book, the only time in the book where Ruth will say Yahweh. This is the only time where she's saying Yahweh. And it's in the form of an oath. Oaths were sworn in the name of one's God. And so by using Yahweh's name in her oath, what she's doing is she's saying, I will take your God to be my God. She's not just using a Jericho, you know, she's forming the oath in the name of Naomi's God, declaring that she will follow Naomi's God. Previously, growing up in Moab, she would have worshipped a different god, Chemosh, probably. It says in 1 Kings 11:17, this is important, Solomon built a high place for Chemosh, the abomination of Moab, and for Moloch, the abomination of the Ammonites, on the mountain east of Jerusalem. So here's this descendant of Ruth will build temples to the gods of the Ammonites and the Moabites in Jerusalem. Again, and to every other god you can imagine. Solomon really didn't care to pick one god over another. One theme of this book, again, this doing an act of kindness or loyalty even when it's not the sensible thing to do. Orpah does the sensible thing. This is this other sub-theme. She obeyed Naomi. She did what seemed best. But Ruth does an act of faith. She does an act of commitment, which is a different kind of thing. What is she doing? She's sacrificing herself for the sake of another. She's doing this sacrificial love. She is saying, I will sacrifice my own life, my own happiness, everything that I have in order to bless you, Naomi. That's what she's doing. Sacrificial love for the benefit of another. She puts everything down, her whole future. Now, it's unknown to us how much faith Ruth has adopted in Yahweh personally from Naomi. We don't really know. I mean, really, think about it. What's her experience? Her experience with Naomi's God is what she gets through Naomi's God. And here's Naomi saying, my God has cursed me, okay? So really, what you need to see here is Ruth's commitment to Naomi's God really isn't a strong commitment to Naomi's God. Because Naomi's God, at this point in her thinking, can't be that great a guy. Because it's not, he's not exactly, you know, making Naomi's life wonderful for her. What you have to see is a lot of Ruth's commitment to Yahweh is because of who Naomi is. Ruth is more likely committing herself to Naomi more than she is to Yahweh. It's important because people's faith in God or their lack of faith in God is often more dependent on the people in their lives than the measurable acts of God. And that's the fact. If the people in your life who say they worship God aren't that good, you won't worship God. If the people in your life who are truly the nicest, best people that you know and say they love God, it's a strong thing for you to be compelled to follow that same God, even when you don't see these overt acts of God. Because Ruth doesn't see the overt acts of God. In fact, what she does see of Yahweh doesn't look that good to her. But what she sees in Naomi is powerful. The God that people know is the one that you demonstrate to them, not the supernatural acts that they see from him. The value system that's attributed to God is the value system that his people live. And that's why we've gotten into this mess. And when Naomi saw that she was determined to go with her, she didn't say anything more. So the two of them went on until they came to Bethlehem. And this whole trip, over. I mean, they fast traveled there, right? All right. They went to Bethlehem. And when they came to Bethlehem, the whole town was stirred because of them. And the woman said, "Is this Naomi?" It's really interesting. This is the Naomi. The town is stirred. The town was stirred. In Hebrew, it's onomatopoeia. That means the sound is the word. We have the word neigh for what horses say. You know, onomatopoeia is a word that sounds like the thing we're saying. The Hebrew word is hum. The town hummed with the news. They were all humming. They were all talking to each other. They were all carrying on. If I recall correctly, other onomatopoeia in Hebrew has to do with grumbling and complaining. Murmuring is the word. "Is this Naomi?" She said to them, "Do not call me Naomi. Call me Mara," which means bitterness. We see this again in the story of the Exodus. They come out the waters of Mara. We will read the word Mara and bitterness in the book of Hebrews again. "Do not call me Naomi. Do not call me pleasantness. Call me bitter, for the Almighty has dealt bitterly with me." This is not a woman that's particularly happy with her God. "I went away full, and the Lord has brought me back empty. Why call me Naomi when the Lord has testified against me, and the Almighty has brought calamity upon me?" Very interesting. The word calamity there. The Lord, or the Almighty, has caused evil toward me. That's the words. He's caused evil toward me. She's not pulling any punches here. The Almighty, Shaddai. We don't know the exact meaning of this. There's theories on it, but we don't know where the word comes from for sure. Could have been from Mesopotamia, brought in with the patriarchs. It could have been an epithet for the Amorite god El in his role of divine warrior, El Shaddai. It was used a lot during the time of the judges, but not so much during the monarchy. So we see the phasing out of this particular name of God, which would make sense if it's connected to a different title of a different god. Also significantly, is she lays the blame squarely with Yahweh. The development of the idea that, you know, the devil runs around and does all these other things is yet to come. I think we'll see a stronger formation of that during the exile to Babylon. It's not a highly developed thing. In fact, early on, you just see, you know, God sends out evil spirits and they do his bidding just like anything else. And really here, What's important in her mind is no other force or power is to blame for the situation, good or bad. She doesn't say the devil did it. She doesn't say it was my fault. She doesn't say it was Molech or Chemoth. She says God did this. She's really, what's interesting, is blaming him, but saying he's still the top of the heap. There's nobody else that can override his will. Which is an interesting combination, isn't it? Which, think about it for a minute. She's saying he alone is in control of life events. So ultimately, the one who complains against God as the author of trouble is better off than the one who denies God completely. She's not denying God and his power. See, even the person who says, God has brought my calamity, still believes in God. He still has a belief, a faith in something. He's not particularly happy with that deity, but there's faith there. It's not like the person says, there is no God. The one who complains against God considers the reality of God as a serious thing. So Naomi returned, and Ruth the Moabite, her daughter-in-law with her, who returned from the country of Moab, and they came to Bethlehem at the beginning of the barley harvest. So that's the chapter. Sets the stage for everything to come. And they're back in Bethlehem, right at the beginning of the harvest, which will be really important in the story.